Good evening, everyone. We are at Hebrews chapter 12, and this letter to the Hebrews, Christians in the first century of a Jewish background who were tempted to go back into Judaism and give up their faith in Jesus as the Christ, Son of God, is coming to a close. And so when you think about Hebrews as a sermon, it really works. And it's as if he knows it's time to wind it up, so he's getting as many points in as possible. Okay? So he's just really, you know, cramming it in there. And that's what we're going to look at tonight. Ray, could you lead us in a prayer as we start our class?
Father, thank you that we're able to be here tonight, and you provide for us this opportunity. And thank you that we're able to see one another's faith as we come together. And as we go through this hour, bless all of us, but especially Philip. He's able to present things faithfully from your word. And thank you for his diligence in serving here as our preacher and our teacher. And thank you for the safe travels they had. And bless our members who are struggling with different things. Please bless Rachel Wicker and help everything to go well with her birth soon. And also the challenges people have with the different things that we know of. Bless them and help us to minister to them as well as we can. And help us now as we go through our class and other classes meeting here also. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
So last week we looked at Hebrews chapter 11, which is a very familiar and often used section of the book of Hebrews. But here's the question. And hopefully what we did last week accomplished what we set out to accomplish. How does Hebrews chapter 11 fit in with the overall letter? Why is this list of Old Testament figures and how they live by faith, why is it, what role does it serve in the letter? Okay, the example that these people press forward because they knew they had better things coming. And toward the end of chapter 10, the writer mentions that they had withstood mistreatment already, knowing that even though they'd lost possessions, they had a more enduring possession waiting for them. Okay? So, what's chapter 11 doing for these people? These Jewish people. Through what means? Beyond what they're facing, the challenges and persecutions and all that. Okay? Did Abraham go through challenges? Did Moses go through challenges? Did David? Did Abraham and Sarah? Okay. So what does this list do of chapter 11? What's it telling these people? You're going to have to endure hardship if you're going to live by faith. And using them as an example is communicating also that your Jewish roots is really in these people's faith. It's not in the rituals of the tabernacle and the Levitical priesthood. It's not in certainly the traditions and superstitions that Jews by the first century had concocted. Your roots as a Jew lies in the faith of Abel, Noah, Enoch, Abraham, Sarah, people who came along way before the law of Moses ever came along. And so chapter 11 serves as like a museum of exhibits of what these people can do if they would persevere. So we come to chapter 12. Okay. I guess you could also say chapter 11 is a them and us approach. If they could make it, then what? You can make it. We can make it. You can persevere in your faith. Now, what's going to happen in chapter 12 and 13 is that he's going to deliver the final exhortations. And don't see it as a disjointed collection of isolated items. That's not what's happening here. There are all kinds of ways in which what's said in chapter 12 and 13 relates back to earlier in the book and ties in all the big ideas, okay? But he is delivering in rapid fire motion, a fire method here, a lot of things to motivate them. I said at the end of the class, he's going to give them a kick in the pants. He's going to light a fire under them. That's another way to put it. Especially chapter 12 is the lighting of the fire and the kicking in the pants. These are his last efforts to motivate them. It's going to include words that would inspire them in a positive way, teachings, although he's done most of the teaching already, and even striking fear in them, which he's done a little bit of that too already. So, all right, chapter 12. Let's look here at verses 1 to 2 and see what's happening first of all here. Can you read that for us, Daryl? 1 and 2.
Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God.
All right, thank you. So he's talking here about a run with endurance. That's the thrust of this section. And to motivate them, he cites witnesses and the founder. So he talks about in verse 1, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. In a way, that is the exhortation that the whole book's been about. And the next chapter here is going to be about that. Run with endurance this race that's set before us. And the fact that it said it's a race and one that's set before us, this means this is a long challenge. This is not just an occasion you rise to, but this is a long challenge. And it's going to require prolonged effort. And it's going to require strenuous effort. This is not something short, simple, and easy. When he says it that way, run with endurance the race that is set before us. It's not something quick, simple, and easy. And then he talks about these witnesses here. Think about it. When he opens this section right here, therefore, building on what he's just said, we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Who are the witnesses?
Chapter 11.
Yeah, all those people in chapter 11, Abel and Enoch and Abraham and Sarah and Moses and Gideon and all those people that he lists in chapter 11. Now, they're depicted as going on in front of them. All right, he's already depicted this as a race. Now, I preached on this text and how this text connects to the rest of the book a few weeks ago. And I talked about how that even though this is addressed to Jewish Christians, they were well familiar in the first century with what? Though they were Jewish, they were very familiar with what? Think about racing. The Greek games. And the running games were the marquee games among the Greeks. They had wrestling and they had discus, what we would call discus, and a lot of other things like that. I think they had archery too. But the foot races were the marquee events. And I would even say still in the modern Summer Olympics, there's something about the running athletes that sort of sets them apart a little bit. And then the sprinters are a certain class, and then the intermediate runners that run like 400s and things like that. And then there are the marathon runners. But there's something really unique about them. And these Jewish Christians were familiar with this. The Romans had set up athletic facilities in Jerusalem when they occupied it, okay, when they were ruling over that area in the first century. And many of the Jewish Christians were from various Gentile territories where the Greek games were commonly known about. Some degree of them were performed around them, some athletic competition in a stadium. But of course, the big games were, you know, over there in Greece proper. But they understand this thing about running. And so he's depicting a picture of you running a race. And there are people who have already finished the race in front of you, who were there and are witnesses. Okay, so let me throw this in. Among the Greeks at certain times, there's evidence that the fathers of the athletes, and the athletes were all male, by the way, but the fathers of the athletes or former athletes were their coaches. That's nothing new, right? I mean, how many dads coach Little League, right? And youth soccer and so forth. How many ex-ball players are coaches? Almost all of them, okay? So it's the idea that these former athletes have run ahead of you, they're finished, and now they're helping you. That's the picture. And you may wonder, are these called witnesses because they're watching, or are they witnesses because they're giving testimony? Well, I would call your attention back to the beginning of chapter 11 and what was said about Abel. At the end of verse 4, talks about by faith Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice. But then it says something else about faith in Abel at the end of verse 4. Through his faith, Abel what? Pardon? Still speaks, though he's what? Though he's dead. Though he's dead, he still speaks. Okay, how? Joe? That's right, reading his example. He's speaking right there, isn't he? In that example of faith. And think about this. Abel, because of his righteousness, was persecuted. How do you like that? Remember their problem. They're being discouraged because they're being opposed. They're being tempted to give up because they're opposed for their righteousness, their belief in Christ. So I think it is true that Abel is not the only one who's dead and still speaking in this chapter. Moses is dead and still speaking, and so is Abraham, and so is Sarah. They're all dead and still speaking. I would have you see that the testimony is their example of faith and what that example testifies to, what it proclaims. That's what a witness does. He proclaims something in some kind of case. And so Abel is still speaking. He and the other witnesses are speaking. And what are they telling these people who are running this race? What are these, all these people in chapter 11? What are, in essence, what are they all saying to him? Don't give up. Keep your what? Keep your faith. No matter what price you have to pay, keep your faith. Don't give up. Run with endurance the race that is set before you. That's what they're saying. All through chapter 11 and all the different ways in which they demonstrated by their faith. Okay. And to do that, to run with endurance, there are two things that are necessary. First of all, they've got to lay aside some things. What? Okay. The weights that weigh them down and entangle them and what else? Sin. Okay. Are they two different things or the same thing? It appears their weights and sins are two different things. We understand that sin can be a weight and hold you back. But think about it. What's holding these people back, potentially, is not necessarily some sin that's being named among them. It's how they're being treated and how they're letting that weigh them down. Although, their lack of maturity has led to this too. We saw that in chapter 4 and chapter 5. So, lay aside the sin and the weight that holds them back. And what's the other thing they do? The most important thing. Look into Jesus. And he is called here, the English Standard says, the founder of the faith. Other translations say the author of the faith. This is an interesting term here, author or founder. And I always thought author was a good way to translate this, but founder's good too. And maybe this is a better way to translate it. Captain It means captain. It means chief leader. It means like the chief of a tribe. So he's the leader, and he's also the perfecter of our faith. Now, I don't want to say 99 times out of 100, but maybe I'll say 89 times out of 100. In the New Testament, when you find the word perfect, substitute the word complete. When we think of perfect, we think of without flaw. And they are connected, but this term here usually means completion or complete. And here it's a person. He's the one who has completed our faith. He's put it all together and completed it. Think about it. Why couldn't the Old Testament priests do that? They had sins themselves. And year after year they would die and they'd have to replace them, right? All kinds of reasons why. But Jesus is the completion of our faith. He completes our faith. Now, how is it that he does that? Well, I think he describes it here. He is the author and finisher of our faith, or the founder and perfecter of our faith. And what two things are mentioned here about him? Next. Who did what? Endured the cross. He is the founder or author of our faith. He is the completer of our faith because he died for us on the cross. And what does it say about the manner in which he went to the cross? Despised the shame of it. In other words, he was willing to go through the shame and just not let it affect him. And what else does it say? What else did he possess? Who for the joy that was set before him. What? How do you reconcile Jesus being crucified and him doing so with joy?
Using his Father.
He was doing the Father's will. And he was accomplishing our salvation. He was completing our faith. So do you see this picture? There's an end, as he says here, who for the joy that was set before him. What do we have set before us? A race. Same idea. Well, Jesus had something set before him, an end result, and he endured the worst thing ever. And he did it with a joy because of what it was going to lead to, what it was going to accomplish. And what else does it say in addition to his cross? That makes him the founder or author of our faith. Seated at the right hand of God. How many times have we seen that in this book? In the book of Hebrews, think about it. In so many books of the Bible, when you think of Jesus and you're picturing him somewhere, oftentimes he's pictured on the cross, and that's good. And he's pictured on the cross in this book. We just saw it in verse 2. But consistently in this book, he wants these Hebrew Christians to see Jesus seated in heaven at the right hand of God, at the throne of grace. And according to the letter, you students of the letter to the Hebrews, what's he doing there in the presence of God, according to this letter? He's acting as the great what? Pardon? High priest. He's the great high priest. So what do high priests do between God and man? Mediates, makes intercession. And the other thing that he's depicted over and over as presenting to the Father once and for all was what? Because this is weird. He's both the priest and he's also the what? He's the sacrifice. Those priests would go in that tabernacle day after day, year after year, doing all those ceremonies, presenting the blood and all that. It didn't accomplish what Jesus did by dying and then presenting his resurrected body to the Father that showed that he had performed the ultimate sacrifice. And we're told earlier in the book that he entered the holy place with blood. Whose blood? His own blood. So, That's why he's the author and perfecter or founder and finisher of our faith, is because of his cross, and now he rules at the right hand of God, interceding for us and presenting himself as the ultimate sacrifice to be the payment for our sin. Okay, see how this section, it's all about the book. Nothing new here. But it's done in such a creative way, you think, well, now he's changing subjects. No, he's not. He's just, this is a masterpiece in how it's constructed. So, okay. And that's just verse 1 and 2. Let's see what else we got here. 3 through 11. Jesse, would you read those verses, please? 3 through 11 of chapter 12.
For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed are for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems to be joyful or the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it.
Thank you. So, verses 3 through 11 here, he shifts from just mentioning Jesus' experience of suffering and enduring that suffering on the cross to shifting to say, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle, see how he shifts. He's connecting Christ and his struggle with theirs. Okay. And what is the key to not growing weary and faint-hearted? According to verse 3, what's the key to not being weary? Looking to Jesus, considering Jesus. Key to not doing that is looking to Jesus or considering Jesus. You can't lean on other people for your faith. You won't make it. Other people can teach you things. They can encourage you. They can give you wise counsel. But they're not the foundation or the pillar for your faith. Jesus is. Because when these Hebrew Christians looked at their fellow Christians, they were seeing people being what? According to chapter 10. Persecuted. Here's a little history fact here. Did you know that not every person who was persecuted for Christ kept their faith? Many of them recanted their faith. Many of them went belly up. Persecution is a fiery furnace, and some people don't make it. So if they were looking to their fellow Christians for strength, sometimes they're going to be disappointed in this. And Jesus is the person that keeps us going. He's the author and perfecter of our faith. That's the key to persevering, is Jesus. Other people can help us. Other people are supposed to help us. We're supposed to help other people. That's the whole dynamic of the body of Christ. But the person who keeps us from falling, the person who sustains us, is Jesus. And he makes this connection here between Christ and their situation. Again, he's our captain. He's our captain in facing hostility. And regarding the struggle they had against sin, that's how he depicts it here. There's different ways you can depict struggling when you're against those who are persecuting you. He depicts it here, a struggle against sin. It's like a universal battle here, so to speak, a cosmic battle, as is depicted in places like Ephesians 6. And what does he say to them? He says, well, in your struggle against sin, you've not yet experienced what? Bloodshed. Okay? And bloodshed means what? Death. Right. Now, this is an interesting argument. You've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Is this possibly a, hey, this is not as bad as it could be kind of argument? Because we use those arguments, right? You know, you have a flat tire. And it's December. And it's traffic zipping by, and it's causing you to be late. And it's hard work to change a tire. And maybe somebody's with you, and they say, well, it's December. At least it's 60 degrees. It's not 30 and snowing. Does that help a little bit? A little bit. It helps a little bit. Okay? And it appears that that's his argument. And he's just been talking about Jesus, the ultimate example of one who shed his blood. Is it possible, not only is he saying, it's not gotten bad yet, which means what?
Worst is yet to come.
The worst may be yet to come. That's why, and this is the section of lighting a fire under them and kicking them in the pants. You better get it on track now, because it's only going to get worse. There's two theories about where these Hebrews were that received this letter. One is they're in Judea, somewhere around Jerusalem. I think that's probably likely. Another theory is they're in Rome. These are Jewish Christians in Rome. We know there are Jewish Christians in Rome. I struggle more with that one, okay? But whether it's Judea or Rome, the real persecution against Christians had not heated up yet. We see Paul being persecuted. But as far as wholesale against Christians, it's not heated up yet. But what's going to happen? It's going to heat up. That's what we're going to study, Lord willing, later this fall when we study the Revelation. The Revelation is about that very thing. It's going to heat up. So he's telling them that they've been mistreated, they've lost property, they've not shed blood yet. So, could be worse. And what that does is it gives you perspective. I mean, if you're changing the tire and your friend reminds you that it's 60 in December and it could be 30, listen, I'll take a 60 degree day in December, it's dry any day, over a 30 degree day and it's snow and trying to change a tire any day. So from that perspective, that is better. There's no padding in this book. There are no soft touches in this book. There's a lot of encouragement, but there are no soft touches. It's a very frank book. Then he elaborates over the next several verses with a further reason, and he really hasn't done it yet except the example of Jesus would be a reason why they're suffering. The example of the people in chapter 11 are a reason why they're suffering. If you live by faith, sometimes you're going to be challenged and suffer. But now he goes along a different line of explaining why they're suffering. What does he say about this from verse 5 all the way down through verse 11? Why are they suffering?
God disciplining them.
Because it's discipline. And this term discipline here, older translations say a chastisement. This is not punishment for punishment's sake. This is training. And the punishment is to teach so that it produces maturity and growth and strength and wisdom and all those kinds of things. And so they're to look at this struggle as experiences that will complete them. And the reason why is because of their relationship with whom? The Father. I mean, isn't that where we sort of always go, even if we don't express it out loud? That if we're following God and bad things are happening to us, we're like, what are you doing, God? Why aren't you getting me out of this? He depicts this struggle against sin, this struggle in their faith being challenged by opponents, as an experience that would discipline them. And look what he says about it. This relationship, I don't have it on screen. This relationship to the Father, verse 10, by being disciplined this way, what can happen for us at the end of verse 10? It's for our good that we may what?
Share his holiness.
Share his holiness. God is trying to get us to become like what?
Him.
Who? Him. And I want you to think about this, his holiness and the idea of persecution. A good reference here, if you want to jot down a cross reference, is 1 Peter 4, 1 to 3. And that letter is about Christians who were facing and were about to face even more persecution. And Paul said, if you suffer in the flesh, you cease from sin. You see, this is what's going to happen. I want you to watch for this dynamic in this text. Either we're going to pull closer to this world, or we're going to pull apart. Holy means set apart. In its essence, holy means to sanctify, to set apart. That's why we're to be different from the world. And to pull from the world, we do so because we know, as the patriarchs knew, there's a better country. There's a builder. There's a city whose builder and maker is God, whose architect is God. We're pulling away from this world because we want to be in the other world. And when in this world we face persecution for our faith, you know what that does? It's that expression where it talks about Jesus disdained or despised the shame. Jesus was not mostly affected by how he was shamefully treated on the cross and the things around it. I'm not saying it didn't affect him, but how he was mocked and ridiculed and beaten and tortured, that was not the thing that mostly controlled him. What controlled him, as Ray said, was obedience to the Father. What controlled him, I think as Earl said, was what he was accomplishing on the cross, our salvation. When we suffer in this world for our faith, you know what it should do? It should pull us away from this world. In our head, in our value system, this world's not for me. This is not my home. I want to be where I'm not treated that way because I love Jesus. I long to be where everybody else belongs to Jesus Christ. So do you see how going through that persecution can actually complete them and separate them from this world to lead them to better things? And then he says, verse 11, it's painful now, but what happens later? It's an agrarian, it's a farming expression. It's painful now, but what?
Yields fruit.
Yields fruit. Peaceful fruit of righteousness. So there's a latter benefit by going through it. All right? Now where does he go? Verse 12 to 17. Rachel, can you read those verses, please? 12 to 17, please.
Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all men, and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled. That there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, through he sought for it with tears.
All right, thank you. A very interesting reference here when he's talking here about the idea of the drooping hands and the weak knees. Flip over real quickly to Isaiah 35. This is a reference, or at least an allusion, to Isaiah 35. Now, here's what Isaiah 35 is. Here's where you set up straight and say, yeah, I know that. Isaiah 35 is one of the classic texts that's a restoration text among the prophets. Remember, we have texts where the prophet condemns the people. We have texts where he pronounces judgment on them. What are the restoration texts about?
Hope.
That one day God's going to forgive and he's going to restore. And Isaiah 35 talks about the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. Okay? If you don't know this with your mind, use your ears right now. Why would the dry land be glad? What's happening right now outside? Rain's coming. Okay, rain's here. Okay? But the dry land is glad because the dry land's anticipating water. Okay? Rain. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. When do blossoms come out in the desert? If you know anything about deserts, after the rainy season or in the rainy season. Exactly right. So it talks about blossoming abundantly, joyful singing. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. End of verse 2. Look at verse 3. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you. Okay. Look how Isaiah uses this expression about strengthen your hands. It's when you're in the desert and you're suffering. And it's when you remember that God has promised to come save you, and that hope does what to you? Makes you stronger. Now go back to Hebrews 11. These people were walking through a what? A desert. They've got to have hope that God is going to deliver them. And in the meantime, what they've got to do is that they've got to collect their strength, renew their resolve, and commit to finish this race. Very similar. This expression here, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees. Drooping hands and weak knees. Just from a physical, medical standpoint, drooping hands and weak knees, what do you think that's what's happened to this person? Strength's been pulled from them. There's different things that do that, like disease does that, injury does that. What's this thing that you call when you don't use muscles? Atrophy. If you don't use the muscle, you lose it. They've not been using their faith and their hope. So what's happening? They're losing it. And there's where that immaturity and lack of knowledge is hurting them, which is what this letter is meant to help with. What's happened is they've gotten weak. What he's telling them now is get yourself strong. And the way you do that is hope and faith. And then he mentions, make straight paths for your feet. This is an interesting background too. The Roman Empire has been around for a while at this point. The Roman roads have been too. And the Roman roads were notorious for ruts. How do ruts form? Continual use on the same path. Did you know that the width of a railroad car that was established in Great Britain in the early 1800s, that it's roughly the same width as the ruts in the ancient Roman roads, because most of the carts in Britain were built to go in those ruts, and so they built the train carriages. Did you know that? Now you do. Okay? So I want you to see this. There's a well-worn path. Get on it and stay on it. What's the well-worn path? Chapter 11. It's following whom? Enoch, Abel, Noah, Sarah, Abraham. And ultimately following whom? Jesus. And another way it's called straight and narrow in Jesus, Matthew 7. He's saying you've gotten out of the rut. We think of ruts being bad. Here it's good. You've gotten off the track. Now, in ancient times, they didn't have paved roads. So if you got off the rutted area, which was well-worn, which was as hard as pavement, if you got off the rutted areas, what could happen? You get bogged down. You're stuck. He's saying, keep going. Run with endurance. Keep moving on this. Okay?
All right.
That's right. Act it. Right. Exactly. Okay? And he's saying here, don't stray. Don't stray. Get back on the path. You know where it's at. And then he breaks into some attitudes and behaviors that relate to what he's already said. When he says, lay aside, verse 1, every weight and the sin which clings to us so closely. What's he talking about here? Well, he's going to talk about some of those. He talks about being at peace with others. If others are mistreating you, think about how it's going to be hard to look at them and treat them in a peaceful way. But that's what a Christian's called to do. And then he gets into bitterness. Make sure there's no root of bitterness in you. What's hard things in life, what's mistreatment going to do in us? It's going to create bitterness if we don't fight it. And then he talks about don't be sexually immoral or unholy, like whom? Like Esau. And how is Esau depicted here? Esau was a man who was driven by what? His physical passions, his impulses in the moment, his temporary desires. And what he's saying here is reminiscent of some things he talked about earlier in this book when he talked about the wilderness wanderings and how that generation fell as an example. Don't want to be like them. Here was the mistake of the Exodus generation. They gave in to temporary impulses instead of pressing on against hard struggle on their way to the promised land. I'm going to say that again. The problem of the Exodus generation is they gave in to their temporary impulses instead of pressing on in the struggle to get to the promised land. I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. I'm tired of this bread. Where's Moses? On and on and on. They were impulsive. They were feeling things in the moment, and they let it rule them. That's just like who? Esau. Esau in the moment said, I'll sell my birthright. Give me that meal. He's acting in the moment. What has this book been saying? There's a better country. There's a better city. You have a better reward. You've got to endure. Christ is in heaven. You've got to look at Him. You've got to run this race. Don't give in to your temporary impulses. So if somebody's mistreating you, if they're taking your goods because you're a Christian, if the authorities are mistreating you, those are all things that create bitterness and discouragement, and we want to physically protect ourselves, and we want to make ourselves comfortable. Here's the world, and here's the other place, heaven. We want to get comfortable in this world. So somebody's mistreating me for my faith. I want to shed that faith so I don't get mistreated because I want to be at ease here. And so he's telling them here, don't be like Esau. However, no matter how this feels in the moment, rise above that, keep the big picture in mind, run with endurance and die to that world and die to those impulses. And I am sad at two levels. I'm sad I'm out of time for this class. And I'm sad we're in chapter 12 and there's only 13 chapters left. Because I feel like we're just getting in the rut here in a good way. So next week, try to wrap at least most of this up. Thank you very much.